Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
And there they were. No moment too soon, the European Commission released the decisions to declare the laws of the United Kingdom as essentially equivalent to the EU GDPR and the European Law Enforcement Directive. The UK is adequate. For now. Because the decisions come with quite a few caveats, most important of which is the sunset clause, meaning that both adequacy decisions will automatically expire after 4 years. Furthermore, the Commission has announced they will keep a serious eye on the UK, both as regards their surveillance laws and their data protection laws. And with good reason, you could say, certainly if you take into account the Tiger report that was released just before the adequacy decisions. What is the Tiger report, you say? Just listen to this sometimes rather cynical episode and you will hear all you need to know about the report and also about the UK adequacy decisions. My name is Paul Breitbarth.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. So I'm really thrilled to have our official, unofficial co-host, Ralph O'Brien, joining us here today. He is our resident UK expert. And y'all don't know this, but typically I invite him to the podcast the night before when he's asleep, so he'll wake up to an appointment on his calendar. So let's go straight into unexpected questions. What is your favorite snack food?
Oh, that's a hard one. Well, at the moment, we're in the middle of the Euros with the football, and of late, we've been ordering pizza during every football match from a certain parlor game-based pizza company. Other pizza companies are available. So, yeah, certainly load me up a meat feast on any day.
Nice. Paul?
I think I would go either for crisps or chips.
There you go. I like it.
Just regular salted, nothing special, no barbecue flavors or cheese, onion or what have
fancy.
You. Just nothing plain fancy, whole. Just plain salted.
And what's your favorite pizza, Ralph? You like thin or thick?
Thick crust, barbecue sauce base rather than tomato. Throw as much meat on there as you can.
That sounds like the meat lovers.
And any vegetables or
The odd bit of onion, that'll do.
I was going to say, unless there's something in the barbecue base, it doesn't sound like it. So I am both a, and I might save this for a secret question one day, is sweet or salty. I'm a both. I'm the one that likes to eat M&Ms with my popcorn. But my favorite snack lately has been, I believe I'm keeping them in business. During the pandemic, there is a gluten-free bakery not too far from here called Spooky Swirls Cafe, and they make the most amazing gluten-free cinnamon buns, and they're about 4 inches across, and they're about an inch and a half thick, and the cream cheese frosting, I swear, is like half an inch altogether, and yeah, now you know why I've gained weight, but
Hashtag no spawn.
Exactly. This weekend, they actually rolled out gluten-free donuts, and they're about the same size. So I had two of the donuts, and yeah, I don't know if I'm going to get in shape after the pandemic or not.
Okay, we need to stop. My mouth is watering. I'm going to have to go and eat in a minute. So.
It is fantastic. So, okay, let's dive straight into the UK.
Ralph, I have a better idea. We should just travel to Arizona and go taste the damn things.
Wait. Until wintertime, just saying. We're running about 117 today, I think. Ralph, what we were joking about on the last podcast is Arizona literally has to be on fire to cool down.
Okay.
The coverage from all the fires, the smoke was blocking the heat, and we were literally in the low 100s, which was, you know, 17, 18 degrees lower than normal.
We're running...
Okay, we'll stick to the UK for
today. We're running about 117 here, but that's millimetres of water.
The same amount as across Kay's desk right now.
I almost had to spit out my water I was drinking. Okay. All right, we're diving straight into the UK. Apparently, diving is the right word here. So we're going to dive straight into the UK. Paul, I give you the honor of the first question. What would you like to hit our guest with today? I was trying
to channel game show. Ralph, are you surprised that the UK even got their adequacy decisions?
Totally. Amazed. No, actually, my prediction was my crystal ball moment was always that the European Commission would politically give adequacy, but I fully expected immediately after the adequacy decision would be released for there to be like this plethora of challenges. Yeah. That's actually what we haven't seen. We haven't seen, activists or a Schrems like court case come along and say, well, I don't think that's true. We're going to take you to court, you know, almost immediately after the adequacy decision was mentioned. What really, really jumps into mind though, and actually I might even read you quotes from them, was the two press releases and just how different they were. And I think the UK is more likely to shoot itself in the foot than any particular campaigner is ever going to.
And would you then refer to the so-called Tiger or Tigger report?
It wasn't only the Tiger report. I mean, if you look at the two press releases, we will talk about the Tiger report, I'm sure. But I mean, if you look at the EU press release, it says, obviously, and I quote, "For the first time, adequacy decisions include a sunset clause, which limits their duration. So decisions will expire 4 years after entry into force. After that period, adequacy might be renewed, but only if the UK continues to ensure an adequate level of data protection. However, during these 4 years, the Commission will monitor the legal situation in the UK and will intervene at any point if the UK deviates from the level of protection currently in place." Now,
so basically, they've put the UK on notice. Don't even think about changing your laws because it will mean that we will repeal the adequacy decision.
Now let's compare that to the UK's press release, which says, a year after constructive court talks, it is right that the European Union formally recognises the UK's high data protection standards. This will be a welcome news to business with continued cooperation. We will now focus on unlocking the power of data to drive innovation and boost the economy. Unlocking the power of data, it was actually a banner put above the new ICO's job description. When the new ICO's job description was advertised by the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, in big pink letters with yellow sort of background, it says, unlock the power of data, enable the government's data strategy. And this was the new ICO.
It was the same job advert that did not include any reference to fundamental rights or data protection, right?
Correct. So what I just found interesting was the two press releases. You know, the EU's press release was full of caveats and warnings. 4 years only, we'll withdraw it if you deviate. Immigration is not included because of the illegal UK immigration exemption that even the UK Supreme Court found to be in contravention of people's human rights.
Sounds like there may have been a translation problem.
Yeah, and then on top of that, as Paul, you've said, you've then got the Tiger report.
Which, don't say Tigger, Paul. Don't say Tigger. You're going to make me start thinking Winnie the Pooh and the Honey Pots.
Well, I mean, that is a fair comparison, given that it is also about the UK and about deviating from what's the standard.
Yeah.
So, Ralph, for those of us for those of our listeners that haven't seen the report and haven't read it, what is it and what does it say?
So, Boris Johnson, the current Prime Minister, asked three MPs, by the way, who also happen to be Brexiteer MPs, to form a board known as Tiger, which is about basically what the UK wants to do in a post-Brexit, freed from all that horrific and horrible EU red tape. Yeah. So it's the Task Force on Innovation, Growth and Regulatory Reform, which makes the wonderful moniker Tiger. They went out and consulted a lot of people. Mostly the people they consulted were business. There's a whole list at the end of sort of business people that they've talked to. I want to note the Information Commissioner is not among them.
Well, that's, of course, because they're not business people.
Exactly. And
do we have a new commissioner yet?
No. Okay. No, the existing commissioner, Elizabeth Denham, has offered to stay on for longer whilst they work out who it's going to be. Yeah. And then Proposal 7 of the Tiger Report is, and I'll quote again, replace the UK GDPR 2018 with a new proportionate UK framework of citizen data rights to give people greater control of their data, whilst allowing data to flow more freely and drive growth upon healthcare, public services, and the digital economy. The preceding paragraphs after that then go on talking about the value of data, how it's highly profitable, how the UK is an opportunity to cement itself in a leader of data and making sure that it has a digital economy based more in common law than legislation. And what I think is really interesting about it is, of course, legislation sets rules up front. Common law polices it at the back end.
Right.
So I think that's a really interesting proposed change. What I would say is the Tiger Report contains some inaccuracies. It talks a lot about...
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
It seems to have some clear misconceptions about what GDPR is. May I read you my favorite quote?
Yeah, go ahead.
Which is paragraph 209.
That's exactly the one I'm looking at.
GDPR is centered around the principle of citizen-owned data, mistake one, and organizations generally needing a person's consent to process their data, number two. There are alternative ways to process data that do not require consent, but these are not well defined, mistake three, or understood, mistake four, causing confusion amongst data processors and controllers. I would say mistake five.
Yeah.
In one sentence.
But then it goes on. It goes on and saying tech giants oblige consumers to consent to the use of their platforms before selling and profiting from data with the illusion that the consumer is in control. So what they're actually doing is they are conflating businesses who actually adopt e-privacy law incorrectly to say that the GDPR is bad. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting. You know, so there's a number of misunderstandings in it. But, I mean, Boris Johnson, our Prime Minister, has endorsed this report and said that it would be wonderful to get rid of all that horrible GDPR regulation and give something a bit more streamlined. And it includes a proposal to reform the GDPR, especially in the realms of artificial intelligence, including specifically removing Article 22 of the GDPR, which we know is about automated decision making, to make AI much more easy to implement within the UK going forwards. To me, this is the exact situation that the adequacy agreement is trying to prevent. Yeah.
If you haven't read the Tiger Report, you should go read the Tiger Report. There's quite a few moments of, didn't. Oh, no, you didn't, kind of thing.
So we may be cynical about this report, but
slightly.
It is a real danger for the business community if this becomes reality, mm-hmm. because already with all the caveats and the sunset clause, the UK adequacy is a rare specimen and is already putting companies on notice. This may not see the end of the 4 years. And yes, you can rely upon it for now, but we are not at the end of the discussion. And this is only throwing a lot of additional oil on the fire.
The final complication I'd add is, of course, part of the UK sovereignty is the DCMS, that's the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, is operating in the UK in a similar role to what the European Commission does, in that it will be able to approve its own adequacy decision. And therefore, we've already seen in a number of the trade deals that the UK is proposing as part of being a sovereign nation and taking advantage of all these great trade deals it couldn't have when it was part of the EU. With Australia, for example, the UK-Australia deal, As part of that trade deal, it's already promised a data adequacy and free flow of data arrangement. So I think what's then really interesting is onward transfer. So if the EU says the UK is adequate, but then the UK wants to say that countries that the EU haven't said are adequate to the UK, that's going to make a really interesting challenge in terms of sort of onward transfer of data from the UK once it's passed into our borders, even if we are adequate. So,
any rumours yet on the United States?
No. Well, not that I'm aware of. I mean, as you know, they're trying to work on a Privacy Shield version 3, which we know immediately would be challenged. I think if the UK comes up with something similar, we'd again see that similar sort of challenge. I think it's really interesting because we've now got this situation where politically you've got the DCMS almost in charge, the Department of Culture, Media and Sport. And politically, it's going to be in their interest to agree to the international trade deals. It's going to be in their interest to try and deregulate the UK. It's going to be in their interest to try and make the UK a really attractive place for business to come and work in, removing red tape and documentation and what they consider to be barriers. I personally don't. My personal opinion is that you can have both. It's not a negative sum. I think that the GDPR actually allows you a positive sum, a win-win solution, where you can have innovation and growth as well as good privacy protections. In fact, I think good privacy protections and the principles in the GDPR are your route to good data management.
Yeah.
But that's just my opinion. I think there's a number of people, and we see the same old myths and preconceptions that the GDPR or the Data Protection Act says no for the last 20 years. And they're not going away.
So would DCMS also be in charge of the adequacy decision under the Law Enforcement Directive?
Yes. In terms of the way data would be transferred outside of the UK, yes. The DCMS and the ICO, of course, will work together. In fact, I've just seen another job advert given out, quite a low-paid job for what it does, but to kind of be in the go-between between the DCMS and the ICO, because the way I see it would be the DCMS would act a bit like the European Commission in granting adequacy and making those sorts of deals and arrangements, and the ICO would act a bit more like the European Data Protection Board as being the person who would have to kind of agree and consult and tell them to be careful and slow down and add in the appropriate safeguard to protect individual rights. That's if, of course, we get an ICO after Elizabeth Denham, who isn't appointed with the job description that we've seen in mind.
So what are your expectations going forward?
Mine? I want to remain positive. With the current government that's in charge, everything seems to be pushing against human rights at the moment. There's a couple of other laws that are going in place about freedom of assembly, those sort of laws against protest will really increase police powers and decrease citizens' rights to be able to protest. There's another law that's in place or soon to be in place called the Online Harm Bill that is calling for protection of individuals online, which, of course, we know is a great thing. But by making sure that individuals can't be anonymous online. Now, whilst that makes sure that paedophiles and terrorists and all those horrible people can't hide, it also makes people who, I don't know, are exploring perhaps their sexuality or exploring their transgendered nature or exploring or having to move because they're literally in danger. Yeah, I think it'll make those sorts of people who are starting new lives for themselves or experimenting with who they want to be that much harder.
Yeah. Which, in speaking of people perhaps being in danger, maybe it's not quite the same thing, but it makes me think about the immigration exception. So talk to me about that.
Well, when the Data Protection Act 2018 was passed, one of the carve-outs was an immigration exemption. So if you are processing data on individuals who want to become a citizen or who have come into the country, their data is excluded from the UK GDPR. So essentially that means that group of people, the immigrants or the people who have not got UK citizenship as such, do not have privacy or data protection rights.
Is that only up until they're granted citizenship, or is that correct, for as long as they're there, period?
Well, correct, but obviously the data that was processed upon them for their immigration status would still be exempt. So that exemption, that carve-out, it's not the people, it's not whether it applies to the person, it's data used for the purpose of, just bear that in mind. So that carve-out, I personally believe, again, robs people of their rights when they need it the most.
Maybe,
you know,
so,
immigrants.
Yeah.
Immigrants are in a real, you know, they're in not a strong position, and therefore, you know, they might need their data subject access rights or their rights to, you know, their rights to make sure that people treat them with fairness and respect. And what was really nice was the UK Supreme Court agreed. The UK Supreme Court has judged that part of the Data Protection Act illegal. Because it doesn't comply with decisions from the ECHR, the European Court of Human Rights. It's interesting. So the government has not yet amended the Data Protection Act to remove it. So that still stays within the
law. But is it ineffective? I mean, if our Supreme Court says something is not legal, then you may still have the law on the books, but you can't do anything with it.
Well, it would be up to the government to pass some sort of law to remove that exemption. That exemption still exists.
Oh, it just doesn't. Yeah. It can't just sit there and be ineffective.
Yeah, the government's response, as I'm aware, is to issue guidance to the judges that says, well, you shouldn't consider the ECHR, now that Brexit has occurred, as binding upon you. You should consider it advisory, but not binding in your judgments.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which, as we know, we as a country, even though we've left the EU, we're still signed up to Convention 108. We're still signed up to the Council of Europe, which is a very different thing than the EU. We're still signed up to the European Convention on Human Rights, all of which, however, does bind the government sovereign power. And, you know, in a post-Brexit world, that's not things that the government is going to want to hear. So it's a very interesting political situation here, especially if you are somewhat of a rights activist. I mean, personally, I welcome the adequacy decision. I really welcome the adequacy decision. It makes my life easier. It makes my clients' life easier. You know, I'm writing a white paper at the moment on SCCs and the new guidance and the data transfers.
Ooh, we want that.
I mean, and that white paper looks at whether a solution is even possible with, you know, cloud providers under scenario 6 of the new guidance from the EDPB.
I saw an article about how the UK, I believe, had published or issued a news release that they intended to adopt the same SCCs with the minor tweaks for, you know, UK in a few months. So they essentially intend to, I guess, either give you permission to use the EU ones if you modify them for UK or issue their own. And isn't that typically what Switzerland does, is basically say, we give you permission to use the EU SCCs?
Yes. However, as you know...
You always have a however.
We're privacy professionals. We always have a however. or it depends, right?
So, Ralph, let's boil it down to the practical level then. So, I know as a company outside Europe, not in an adequacy determined area, so I'm not Canadian, and I'm not on the Isle of Man or in Jersey, but I want to do business in the EU. So I know that I have to appoint a representative because I don't have a physical presence there, and I know a lot of companies have been getting in trouble lately for not having an EU representative appointed. But, you know, I had one appointed in the UK, and now it doesn't do me any good in the EU. So,
yes, well,
on a practical level, what does this mean companies need to do?
When it comes to EU representatives, at the end of the day, you have to remember that when the UK left the EU, we essentially mirrored the GDPR within UK local law.
So oh, yeah, that's right. On a previous podcast, and I'll link it here, you gave me the full name of the UK GDPR with the Data Privacy Act and the extension and everything. Okay, I'll try to pull that back up.
Yeah. So, under the Data Protection Act, as amended by the Data Protection Privacy Electronic Communications 2019 EU withdrawal, as amended by, et cetera, et cetera.
Now I don't have to go pull it up.
You will see that every time it says member state, it essentially crosses that bit out of the GDPR and writes the UK. And therefore, where territorial extent, for example, in the EU says, you know, anybody outside the EU that's marketing products and services at people in the EU would be covered by the GDPR, and therefore under Article 7 need an EU representative. The same as in the UK Data Protection Act, or the UK version of the GDPR. It says that anyone who is outside of the UK or not established in the UK, but marketing products and services at the UK, would therefore be within territorial scope and would therefore need a UK representative. So it's not only appointing an EU representative, but you may well have to appoint a UK representative. Now, what's interesting is that would also include companies, let's say, in France and Germany that are marketing products and services at the UK but don't have a physical establishment here.
That's where I was about to go with that. It's the same thing for that. So essentially, if you're in the UK and you don't have a physical presence in Europe, you need to now appoint a European representative, and vice versa. If you're in Europe and you used to just completely just do business in the UK, now you actually have to appoint a UK representative.
And that's, of course, regardless of any sort
until
of
this adequacy came up
for international transfer. No. It's regardless of the adequacy. So, you know, regardless of the adequacy agreement, you would still need that. Which I know you're talking about with Paul. So
no, you know, I actually like that. So when I made the earlier comment about, you know, I'm not in an adequate country, that's beside the point. Even if you're in a country that's been deemed adequate, but you don't have a physical presence in the UK or in the EU, you need to still appoint a UK or an EU representative.
Yeah, I think the idea of the representative was always one of enforcement.
It's for jurisdiction.
If you're going to put extraterritorial extent in the law, and the regulator wants to go over after a data controller that happens to sit in Turkey or in the US or in China, well, then you've got to put something in that law that says you need a UK or an EU address in order for us to get in contact and speak with somebody who does fall under our jurisdiction.
Right. And
in fact, I believe it's Spain that even includes an obligation on that representative to be liable for any fine.
You know, I like that. And funny enough, when it first came out, the way I interpret it, and I think in effect the way it is it's to make sure you have jurisdiction over the companies. It's kind of like if you're going to do business here in the U.S. and you're not established in a state, you have to appoint someone in that state to accept service for you. And that's to make sure they have jurisdiction over you. So that's the same thing. And so I had always wondered when it first went in, well, what happens if a company refuses to appoint a representative and they're still going to argue you don't have jurisdiction over me? So I've been meaning to look up the one company that we looked at, the Locate My Family, who got in trouble for not having an EU representative appointed and just kept refusing to respond to them whatsoever. And so
was that the $575,000?
It might be. I'd have to look it up, you know, and we have time to look it up right now. So I will. And I was looking up some of the other fines online yesterday, and they range anywhere from the insufficient response to data protection authority. I can't remember the exact title, but it ranges anywhere from 500 euros up to, I think the highest one I saw was 40,000 euros. Now, whether or not that was the overall fine or the fine specific for that violation was interesting. And most of them seem to be coming out of Spain, as you mentioned.
Yes. Spain, as we all know, has taken over 300 enforcement actions. I mean, you compare that to the UK ICO, which has taken, you know, 4 or 5 enforcement actions under the GDPR, and all of them have been for inadequate security, essentially. What I think is really interesting and where I'd actually kind of prefer enforcement to go is you look at someone like Spain that's issuing 3,000, 20,000, 40,000 much lower value fines but actually based on what I call ground level GDPR enforcement. Things like lack of legal basis, lack of privacy notice, lack of following the principles, lack of upholding individuals' rights. Me personally, I'd much rather see greater number of lower value fines upholding and enforcing GDPR principles than three or four massive fines for security breaches.
Right, and locate my family was the 525 euro one. And part of that, I don't know which part, was because they don't have an EU representative appointed. And so I find that interesting because now you turn around to the new standard contractual clauses. I know we're going to talk about them later. But now you turn around and look at the standard contractual clauses. And if your company or its particular processing activities are directly subject to GDPR Article 3.2, then you don't have to use the transfer SCCs in order to transfer data. Now, a company can't have it both ways. They can't take advantage of being subject to GDPR and not use the transfer SCCs, but then say, oh, but we don't have an EU representative, therefore you can't enforce against me because you don't have jurisdiction. So I thought it was a really brilliant way for the relevant authorities to come up with a backdoor leverage. But I don't know if they did it deliberately or if it's just a nice byproduct.
Well, again, you know, I have to talk as the UK as a carve-out here, though most of my clients are global.
But y'all are going to come out with it, right?
Obviously. Well, who knows? I mean, the ICO is obviously looking at, here in the UK, is obviously not an EU supervisory body anymore. The EU SCCs that have recently come out technically don't apply here in the UK.
Right.
So I think it's going to be really interesting to see the ICO and whether they bring out something that is equivalent or similar, identical, or indeed something completely different.
So what do you think about the EU Cloud Code of Conduct? Is that something we can kick off in the UK too?
What we can say, you know, what we can say is that the ICO is responsible for dealing with codes of conduct and certification, approving them on behalf of the UK. So if we were to introduce something like the EU Cloud Code of Conduct as an international transfer mechanism, it would be the ICO who would have to approve.
Right. And do you support codes of conduct?
Definitely. I mean, I come from a background of actually standards and certification. I used to be a 27001 assessor. I still sit on the committees that write the 27001 and 27701. I've recently helped one of TrustArc's customers actually make their submission and make sure that they're, you know, compliant with the EU Cloud Code of Conduct. So I think they're really useful. I think they're a really good way of providing assurance in the supply chain. Of course, what they don't do is prevent national law from applying.
Right.
And therefore, you know, things like FISA or Executive Order 12333 or you know, Patriot Act.
The Investigatory Powers Act.
Yeah, RIPA in the UK. More transparent, perhaps, than the US mechanism, but still something that needs to be looked at. And, you know, in the adequacy agreement, they said RIPA was fine. People like Big Brother Watch or Privacy International might not necessarily agree, but the European Commission says that RIPA's fine. It's there in the adequacy agreement in black and white.
Well, I'm sure that in the next 2 years we'll hear from Judge Van Danwitz what he thinks about it when the case comes before the Court of Justice of the European Union in Luxembourg.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting. Very interesting indeed. And, you know, but bear in mind, the Court of Justice of the EU technically has no binding power in the UK anymore. And, you know, the government are even encouraging judges to not pay attention to the European Court of Human Rights, which, of course, we are still subject to in Strasbourg.
And will that change, do you think? I know that when Theresa May was still Prime Minister, she called for the UK also to leave, or actually before leaving the European Union, already leaving the European Convention on Human Rights. That call didn't land very well, I think, so at that time. Mm. But maybe that situation has changed as well.
I mean, I personally wouldn't be in support of that. You know, I'm personally a privacy advocate and I'm a big fan of human rights. One of my fears, one of my Brexit fears would be a reduction rather than strengthening of human rights here in the UK. So I'd naturally be a proponent of keeping our membership of the Council of Europe. I'd naturally be a proponent of keeping our adherence to the ECHR and the judgments of the ECHR, because whilst the UK, you know, there's a big move towards it being a sovereign nation and retaining all of its powers, I believe governmental oversight is more and more important. The more power you give to any government, the more checks and balances you need in order to ensure that the citizenry, you know, have some power, or else you end up in a very different type of country than we're used to enjoying.
So, yeah, Ralph, so when we invited you to come on the show, which was essentially overnight while you were asleep, was there anything that you wanted to make sure that you share with our audience about the UK, about the circumstances we're under that we haven't touched on yet?
There is some bright lights. I've probably been quite negative. I've probably been quite cynical.
No, not you. I mean, cynical is not your middle name.
No, that was just me.
Yeah, but, you know, I am quite facetious with it. But at the end of the day, I mean, there is hope. My hope, what I find really interesting is that regulators are starting to talk about data ethics. They're starting to realize that... company, they don't have enough resource to go after large companies, and therefore a better way of dealing with those large companies is, rather than, you know, throwing millions of pounds into enforcement and cases that they might probably lose because that company's got bigger resources than they do, bigger resources than the country might have, is to encourage that company to walk down a path of getting it right for their own benefit. Of almost a data ethics approach, a privacy by design approach, using privacy and data protection rights in marketing to make sure that companies do get it right. So there's actually a slow recognition amongst business, and I'm hoping to see more of it, that data protection isn't some bad, horribly cost to the business, but can be a real benefit. And there are a lot of businesses out there, especially global businesses, that are now starting to say, look, we don't care where we are. We don't care if we're in the EU. We don't care whether we're in the US. We don't care if we're in the UK. What interests us is doing the right thing. And the right thing that will bring us revenue is having great products with great user experience that we can deliver for the benefit of our customers across the globe. So there's your way of life.
And the epitome of that is Apple, who's advertising privacy all over the place. So you're right. They're definitely leveraging it. So on this last question, and then I'll let you go. So as an Englishman, what do you think about the U.S. privacy laws that are coming into action?
Should I answer that culturally as an Irishman?
You live in the U.K. I'm calling you an Englishman.
I think, I mean, you know, we've seen new laws pop up in the US. I was delivering a course on US law to a Maltese gaming company last week, actually.
Oh, I bet that was fascinating.
Yeah, we really highlighted the differences between EU and US law, looked at the fragmentation of US law into the sectoral model. And we really looked at the rise of state laws, which historically have been data breach laws. But now, you know, you see the CCPA or the CPRA. You've seen Virginia, now Colorado. I think it'll be interesting just to see how many. We've also seen Senator Gillian, and I forget her surname, who has introduced the Federal Data Protection Act as well, with the idea of creating a national regulator for data protection as well. So I just wonder how many US states it'll take before a federal omnibus privacy law is brought in that preempts the state law.
Okay, Paul and I have a bet going of how many state laws it's going to take before we see a federal one get serious. What's your number?
My number? 50 US states. But then again, some are blue and some are red. And historically, the blues tend to go more for privacy and the red tend to deny. I don't think it's a number of states. I think it will be the type of states. You know, I think you'll see perhaps some of the large coastal states go first. And I think it'll more be when you get the corners, you know, when you get the large coastal states investing in privacy.
You mean when Washington finally passes what we keep hoping they're going to pass?
Yeah, I mean, that'll be the trigger. I think it's really interesting that you've now got a proposal for a federal law which creates a regulator. That's almost putting the cart before the horse. That's like having an omnibus regulator before you have an omnibus law. You know, so I think it'll be a really interesting situation. But I think there is a recognition across the US, especially by US business. And I think that's actually almost largely due to the GDPR as well, sort of coming across, people recognizing they need these global gold standards in order to transfer data. So I do have hope for the future. Of course, I have hope for the future. I have hope for humanity.
Wonderful. And on that note, that very positive note in this fairly cynical podcast today, and we end another episode of Serious Privacy.
And Paul,
thank you for listening.
Let's not forget to remind our listeners, I know this isn't going to come out until next week, but the recording will be available tomorrow. We're doing a webinar for TrustArc on EU data protection and what's new in Europe and what we're seeing there. So if you're hearing this a week after, you know, we record it for publishing dates, just know that you can go listen to the webinar, get more insight on what's coming out in Europe and what actions you need to take.
I'm off to watch EU Germany in the football. England Germany in the football. Bye bye.
Thank you for joining us, Rob. So yes, thank you again for listening to another episode of Serious Privacy. If you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us and rate and review our episodes in your favorite podcast app. Should you have any questions or suggestions, and especially if you would like to be a guest, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustarc.com or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as Europol B. Thank you for listening. Until our next episode, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.